What does humble pie taste like?
What did we compare apples to before oranges?
And were the ancient Greeks the first to spill the beans?
We've got some edible idioms that are absolutely bananas, but we're sure they'll be just your cup of tea on this episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jessica Ferris, author of Useless Etymology and Words from Hell. And today we're spilling the beans on some snackable idioms and their origins.
Yeah.
I think we should start like right there, right?
With spill the beans, yes.
Yeah.
Why not? By the way, we weren't supposed to make all of these idioms about food, but I don't know if we were hungry or whatever. We just compared our notes and all we seem to have are nutritious idioms and their origins for you today. Let's begin, with spill the beans. So spill the beans is one of those ones that has a common theory about it. The sort of thing that, you know, your dad will explain to everyone at the pub or over the Christmas table.
Is it one of those that's a little bit too neat?
I would say so. So what I'm going to do is I'll tell you what the theory is, and then I'll tell you why I think it's unlikely. Okay. So the theory behind spill the beans is that it goes back to ancient Greece.
Oh, yeah.
Where part of the electoral process involved placing beans in either a hat or a bag. Choose your vessel. It depends on the source that you're reading, but one representing the candidate that you want. And so the phrase spill the beans either comes from the result process of deliberately tipping out these beans, and whoever had the most beans had been elected, or it comes from someone accidentally knocking over the hat or the vessel or whatever, and the beans being spilled accidentally revealing the secret of the secret ballot, that is, you know, how many votes this person has got.
That sounds very tidy, and it also sounds anachronistic because, like, spill the beans is a relatively new term, I would assume, in terms of English, and the likelihood of modern English describing that from Greek elections seems low.
You've nailed it, Jess. This doesn't start appearing anywhere until the 20th century in English. In the United States, which, you know, is no more reason that it wouldn't be from ancient Greece than it appearing in the UK, but nevertheless, if it's coming out of 20th century America, probably not from ancient Greece. Also, did the Greeks drop beans into jars for elections? Well, we do know that they did drop pebbles into jars as part of their election process, because the Greek for pebble is psephos, from which we get the word cephology, which is the study of elections. How about
that?
Cool. That is a cool little fact in itself. Could you describe these pebbles as beans? Yes, I suppose you could. But I think that anachronism that you talk about, the fact that it just doesn't line up with the timings with which we say it, and the fact that they aren't really beans, does make that explanation not exactly watertight.
Right. We run into this a lot with idioms. Like, it's fun to talk through the like elaborate stories and theories, but in many cases, these hypotheses, not theories, are, you know, a little too tidy and don't quite line up. And it's probably the more logical or straightforward explanation. Kind of sucks to spill your beans.
Yeah. Yeah. So to spill the beans is to reveal a secret, kind of, isn't it? But there's a more modern phrase that the kids are using these days, spill the tea, which is more like to reveal some gossip.
Yeah, spill the beans is accidental, right? And then spill the tea is intentional.
Yeah, there you go. That's the key difference here. So I was wondering, because I'm not really down with the kids, what this spill the tea business means. But I mean, to say it's a modern phrase is, yeah, it's not from the noughties. It's not from this millennium. You know, it's from the late 20th century. It's from black drag culture, actually.
Cool.
The phrase. Yeah. Where revealing your T, spelt just the letter T, means revealing your truth. But that could sometimes be written T-E-A because it's just kind of fun to pun on T being T. So we then have this idea of spilling the tea. Lady Chablis was a major figure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil too. she appears in that as well.
Yeah, and in an interview published in 1994, she described certain men becoming violent when they learned of her tea, and she meant her truth. And from that, spilling the tea could also be, you know, revealing the truth about someone else, i.e. revealing some gossip.
I wonder to what extent it has been influenced by memes like sipping tea, like when you're judging someone while not paying attention to them, you know, listening in on a conversation that's juicy.
I did have a look at alternatives to spill the beans or spill the tea in other languages, by the way. French has vendre la mèche, which means to sell the fuse or reveal the fuse. And it's the idea that you've accidentally left the fuse of a mine sticking out so that people can see it, so they know where the bomb is. Spanish has descubrir el pastel, which is to reveal the cake. I'm not quite sure what they're getting at with that. I bet it's a secret cake, some sort of secret cake. And Dutch has, oh no, this is going to sound terrible out of my mouth because I'm not going to be able to pronounce it, but it's something like nu komt de aap uit de mouw, which means now the monkey comes out of the sleeve. I don't know what the monkey was doing up the sleeve. I think it's about a magic trick or something like that.
Yeah, I can see that. That's kind of like, it's got cat out of the bag energy, but more magician-y.
It has cat out of the bag energy. And we covered cat out of the bag in a previous idiom. It's nothing to do with a cat of nine tails, as people like to say, but it's more to do with the idea that you bought a pig in a poke, a pig in a bag, or, you know, whatever. You think you've bought a good animal in a bag, but what you've actually bought is a bad animal, which is a cat, because no one wants to eat a cat.
Another tea-related idiom is a cup of tea, like you are someone's cup of tea.
Oh, yeah, not my cup of tea. Yeah, we do say that a lot, particularly over in Britain.
The earliest appearances we have of these, it dates back to 1908, but we have this sort of popularization in the 1930s via Punch magazine. It's a good concert, but it's not my cup of tea. We have earlier instances of it being your cup of tea, something you like. The notion here is that that everybody likes their tea a little bit differently. You know, do you want your cream or your sugar? Do you say black or do you see it?
Well, we don't put cream in it, Jess. But you would have it black or not. Although, I mean, if you asked for an English breakfast tea black, you would get kicked out of the country.
Fair enough. But yeah, it's a simple enough association. It's everybody likes their tea a little bit differently. Everybody has their favorite blend or strength or style.
We are very particular about how our tea is served, and it is different for every individual. I used to work with a guy who, if you offered to make him a tea, because he would chain drink tea. This is very normal office behavior. He would give you his mug of his last tea where he had left a small morsel of it. You have a morsel of water, of a liquid? No, he'd left a drop of it just so that you could see the color of it, because there's like a whole spectrum of shades of tea color going from, you know, deep, dark, Trumpian tan to something sort of pasty, like a ghost's face. And everyone is somewhere along that tea spectrum.
Like a ghost's face. That's not something I ever would have affiliated with tea.
Looked like a ghost's face, this.
We have a few other tea idioms, right? We've got not for all the tea in China, which dates back to the late 19th century, meaning under no circumstances or not at any price. Notion being tea was costly and an import. And then storm in a teacup, which is a slightly more newer version of tempest in a teapot. Same notion there.
Oh, tempest in a teapot goes back further than storm in a teacup.
Yeah, slightly, yeah. Back to the earlier 1800s.
Over in America, you're much more keen on your coffee, although we do enjoy a cup in Britain as well. Have you got any coffee idioms for me?
The cup of Joe.
Yeah, who's Joe?
This is a subject of debate and it's slightly unknown, but there are a couple cool theories. It's a colloquial term for coffee, first documented in the 1930s. And the best supported explanation traces it back to the earlier slang Jamoke, which is a blend of Java and Mocha, two of the world's best known sources of coffee. By the late 19th century, Jamoke was common American slang for the drink, and naval glossaries from the 1930s have this like Jamoke, Java, Joe, coffee all together in one definition. But there are some other theories, like one involves the U.S. Secretary of the Navy, Josephus Daniels, who in 1914 banned alcohol from officers' messes by what was called General Order 99. Sounds very Star Wars, but there's no evidence of this. There's like, we don't have any record of Cup of Joe before the 1930s. And this happened well before that.
You know, it's a particularly fecund period for
idioms. It is, yeah.
Early 20th century United States. There's just a creative boom in idioms. And we're going to keep coming back to like the 1920s, 30s, 40s during wartime as well.
Surely it's got to be like radio and TV and whatnot.
Yeah, I guess that's when they start to spread.
Another explanation for the Cup of Joe is that it's like the same as the average Joe, the common man. So just the ubiquitous American beverage, cup of the common fellow. Also probably unlikely though.
This is one of those themes that keeps coming up in our episodes, isn't it? Names for the everyman. Like they've changed over the years. Joe's particularly popular in the United States over the past 100 years or so, but Jack has been popular. Dick has been popular, which is why we have things like Spotted Dick.
Heck, Guy, right?
Yeah, Guy. Yeah, of course. Guy is just a person's name, isn't it? That's applied to the every person nowadays. Can I give you a coffee-adjacent idiom?
Yes, yes, please.
Full of beans, as your coffee cup might be.
Oh, very nice, very nice.
You any guess where that comes from?
No, I have no idea.
Can you have any guess what species it's talking about?
Species?
Yeah.
Tell me.
So it's originally applied to horses. It's a term from the stables from the 1800s where a horse would be fed on beans to prepare it for a race, for example, or for a hunt. And bean-fed horses were considered to be in particularly fit condition. I've got a quote here.
Like higher protein? Is that what we're going for?
I don't know about the actual science of it, Jess. I'm not a horse nutritionist, but I have got a quote from 1843 that says, "Ounds, osses, and men are in a glorious state of excitement, full of beans and benevolence." The focus there is on the osses, as it's written in this quote. The horses. Another quote from 1874 refers to it as originally being stable slang. However, it has a different meaning. And I just wonder if you've ever heard this alternative meaning of full of beans, because there are quite a lot of recorded usages of it like this, but I've never heard it. But it describes being full of beans as being arrogant or purse proud. Don't know what purse proud is. A person whom sudden prosperity has made offensive and conceited is said to be too full of beans. Have you ever heard of that?
No, but that's cool. I mean, I think it's good logic.
Mm? Yeah, it does make
purse proud.
A bit more purse proud. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So if you suddenly come into some money and you're suddenly Johnny Big Balls.
Throwing around your cash.
Why do I keep saying things like Johnny Big Balls? That's the second time I've used that phrase. I have no idea where it's come from.
I'm here for it.
Yeah, it's described as being full of beans.
Should we move to another type of food?
Oh, yes, please.
I ended up accidentally, like, I have many, many apple and banana idioms. One of them being the apple of my eye, which I don't think this is that surprising, but it does have some interesting history behind it. It was kind of a literal anatomical term. In Old English, the apple of the eye meant the pupil, which was imagined as a small, round fruit, because at this point, apple just meant any kind of fruit, which we've discussed before. This version of it appears in the Psalms and a couple of other records from Pope Gregory's time. The notion is that the pupil is vital and it's vulnerable. And in Old English, we also had Latin versions of kind of the same notion, pupilla oculi. So similarly, like the eyes apple.
The word pupil literally is related to the word people, isn't it? It describes a person because people would look into someone else's eyes and they would see themselves, right? And they would see a little reflection of themselves in the pupil, which is adorable. So you can imagine, I know someone talking about someone being the apple of their eyes. It's like, you know, a little version of them hidden behind their eyes.
And this is also a translation of a Hebrew phrase that means the little man of the eye, which is also a notion on the reflection of a person who's visible in someone else's pupil. Shakespeare also has Oberon enchanting a sleeper with a love potion by saying, "Flower of this purple dye, hit with Cupid's archery, sink in apple of his eye."
Oh, beautiful. Actually, while I was doing my... you appear to have gone down a fruity rabbit hole, and I went down a vegetable one.
No,
I got
no.
salad days as well, which I don't know if everyone knows this one, but there's another Shakespearean one. It's from Antony and Cleopatra. Cleo says, "My salad days when I was green in judgment, cold in blood." And I don't really think you can explain the idiom better than that sentence itself.
Does salad have a different notion here?
So salad, right, in French, from which we took the word, means a lettuce.
It also means salted, though, right?
Yeah, well, you have to go further back for it to mean that. Yeah, okay. That's what it meant to the Romans, right? It does come from, a salad could be salted meats. It could be anything salted. But salade in French means lettuce. So the idea of being, you know, green and cold.
I see, okay.
As Cleo describes her blood and herself, meaning naive, though green obviously being a, you know, a pun on the term green being, meaning naive as it does, like an unripe fruit, for example. That's what she's referring to here.
I could move us over to a fruit salad if you'd like.
Yeah. I mean, I must say it is the most disappointing of desserts.
You could, I mean, it depends on where you are, because fruit salads in the United States involve a lot of sugar and other things. We've talked about ambrosia before.
So here in Germany, the word salad is really weird. I mean, you'll know potato salad is not what we would call a salad anywhere else. I mean, here the word salad is applied to anything that has got a lot of mayonnaise.
Yeah.
Basically.
Same.
Which I'm on board with. I eat a lot more salads since I moved to Germany.
Right.
But tell us about fruit salads.
I'm going to tell you about apples and oranges, which presumably you could make a salad out of. Do you know what apples used to be compared with?
I automatically leap to apples and pears, don't I? But no, I have no idea.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay. Is that more common?
No, I'm thinking of the Cockney rhyming slang for stairs, really, aren't I?
Oh, but, okay.
But there's a reason they group those two things together. I think it must have been quite common to say apples and pears.
The notion is like apples to oranges is a comparison of things that are different, right? But the original idiom was apples to oysters.
They are much more different, right?
Right, exactly. You would think so. That makes sense. This dates back to the 17th century. John Ray has "as like as an apple to an oyster," shorthand for two things that share absolutely no resemblance. But then by the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the oyster had slipped out of the picture and the fruit bowl had expanded, you might say, with the idiom apples and oranges appearing in political and psychological writing to make like a false equivalent. In fact, in the American Academy of Political and Social Science, it warns against treating commercial and investment banking as though they were the same. It is as impossible to add apples to oranges and get peaches. So we're adding another fruit here. And then Psychological Review says test designers were doing something akin to adding apples and oranges when they combined the scores from mismatched subtests, which I see why apples and oranges make sense there, because they are slightly, they're more similar, the two things that we're comparing. Oysters appear to have been displaced by the oranges in general.
Yeah. So comparing apples and oysters would be to stress that you're comparing two things very, very different, right? Whereas apples and oranges, it's where you've made a bit of a mistake here, because two things, you know, on the surface are related, but they're very different.
I think we've lost the nuance in usage over time, though, because I often hear people saying apples to oranges as if they are two very different things. Maybe some of the people I'm surrounded with use less nuance in their fruit salad idioms.
No, I think I would concur with that, Jess. I think people do say it about things that are very different now.
What about bad apples when you don't want to put in your fruit salad?
So wait, there's the full phrase. What is it? The bad apple spoils the bunch or something like that?
For one rotten apple, little and little, putrefieth an whole heap. Back in a Reformation pamphlet from 1528. But it does have earlier versions too. We also have a rotted apple among the holden maketh roti the sound, which is one apple among the others makes the whole others rot. That's from a 1340 Kentish moral treatise.
Yeah, I mean, that's just based on a sort of truism.
I think it is true that you can put more ripe fruits next to each other to make them ripen faster, but I also don't know that much about fruit outside of idioms.
Yeah, it's definitely true, isn't it, that if you put a banana near other fruits, it makes them rot faster.
Yeah.
That's what people say. That's why people have that like banana hanger thing. Do you know the thing I'm talking about? It's just suspend your bananas.
Wrapping the banana's stems and then separating the bananas. I don't actually know which one works. Oh. I have tried several of them with mixed results.
Let me see if I can come back at you with a vegetable-y idiom. Couch potato. Do you know where couch potato comes from?
Probably a sofa.
Yes, it does. It does. And it's about to celebrate its 50th anniversary as a phrase, because it was supposedly coined in 1976 by a guy called Tom Yachino, an American. He and his TV watching friends used to describe themselves as the couch potatoes. But the couch potato is actually a pun on another phrase for people that watch the telly. Now, I have never heard a television referred to as this, but tell me if you have. But apparently it was common in the 70s to call the TV the boob tube.
Yeah, I do hear that one. That does happen here.
To me, a boob tube is what women wore in the 90s. You know, it's like a... No, really? I mean, it's a garment, like a boob tube. So anyway, the extension is, if the TV is the boob tube, the people watching it are boob tubers. And what is a potato?
Is that what we are?
Sounds like it. Not quite. What is a potato? It is a tuber. So the pun is on...
Oh, that's funny. Tubers. That's so much better than I thought it would be.
So, got to say, Tom Yachino never explained why they were called couch potatoes. So these are theories. So there's that one. There's the boob tube pun. There's the idea that just being slouched in front of a television makes you look a bit sort of potato-y, spuddy. I don't really buy that one, to be honest, because it's not the first idea that comes to my head when I see someone sitting on a sofa.
You look like a potato.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good retrospective explanation, but it's not a good reason to coin the phrase, I don't think. And the third is that you're somewhat vegetative and brainless while sitting before the idiot box, which it could be as simple as that.
So I'm going back to apples again because I got a lot of apples. How do you like these apples?
I'm sure I will like these apples, Jess.
That one's older than I thought it would be, 1895. How do you like them apples?
Wow.
In the original context, it's from the Bryan Daily Eagle from Texas. Bryan has outpaced rival towns in cotton receipts. And the writer caps the boast with, how do you like them apples? Which is like, how do you like those results? The idea is probably owes more to the idiomatic availability of the fruit as a humorous all-purpose noun than to anything in particular. But I wonder if like cotton bowls might be the notion there too. Like the idea of cotton as a fruitful crop being the, you know, apple some other context. So I don't know.
The way the fella's using it there, it's clearly a phrase already, right? That he expects people to understand.
People who are listening to this may be like, well, I've heard another explanation for it. And it is that during the First World War, the phrase was affiliated with toffee apples being a type of large spherical mortar shell. And as you lob one at somebody, you would say, how do you like them apples? But that is probably not the case. It's A, it's older than that. And B, it probably did not come from that notion.
Because the word grenade literally means... pomegranate.
Which also means apple of, like, grainy apple. That's what it is.
Is it grainy apple? I wasn't sure if it was apple of Granada or apple, isn't it? No, I think you're...
Let's double check. Right.
But the pommy at the start of there is the same as the pom in French, meaning apple.
It is a grainy apple.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense. And also the grenade, not only when you look at them, they do look like pomegranates, but also, you know, they explode and bits come out of them. Like pomegranate seeds.
That would be a big apple, which is also an idiom.
Yes, indeed.
It is synonymous with New York City. The big apple has been in idioms since the mid-19th century in American slang. To get a big apple meant to stake something with absolute confidence. Try it once and we'll get you a big apple. That you do it every year hereafter. Oh. Similarly, wagers could be referred to as a big red apple. That appears in newspapers through the late 19th century and early 20th centuries, often in advertising. So the apple was a stand-in for something desirable, wholesome, and sure, which is also like, that also extends to the logic of how do you like them apples. So that helps explain that one a little bit too. The sense that stuck with New York City started in the early 1900s. Writers used Big Apple more broadly for something of great importance or ambition. We've got a couple of references in 1909 saying that the Big Apple, New York, gets a disproportionate share of the national sap. So they said, the idea being that the big apple on the tree gets the nutrients from the tree. But the thing that made it stick actually came through horse racing. In 1921, Morning Telegraph sports writer John J. Fitzgerald used the Big Apple to mean the New York racetracks, the richest circuit in the country. So same idea, the wealthiest, biggest, most nurtured thing that kind of made it stick around.
It's almost insulting then, right? It's almost sort of, I don't know, a big begrudging name given by everyone else to the Big Apple. It's not the boast that it kind of sounds like.
That's how New York kind of sees itself, though. It takes its worst qualities and then brags about them and makes them a bit of a sticking point or a chip on their shoulder, to use a bunch of other idioms. But the
chips
the
are thing, food.
Indeed. Oh yeah, you know. But chip on your shoulder is.
I don't think it's about someone with a French fry on their shoulder. Or
No. I was thinking gambling, probably. Right.
I've always thought of it as someone somehow having a chip in their shoulder, which I guess doesn't make much sense.
I don't know if this is true or not, but the explanation you run into a lot is that when you wanted to fight, you would put a chip of wood on your shoulder and dare someone to knock it off.
Oh, okay. So if someone's got a chip on their shoulder, they're kind of stirring for a fight about something.
Looking for a fight. Yeah.
Well, Jess, you really seem to know your onions about these fruity idioms. Have you ever wondered where know your onions comes from?
No one has ever said the phrase know your onions to me before until now. So,
have you not heard this? Okay, that's fine. Normally I would go, oh no, it's a Britishism. But it's not. It's an American term. I know this for a fact because almost all the first usages of it come out of the United States. And the timing of that is crucial because there's a very common explanation for where know your onions comes from. It's an explanation for it in Britain. The onions in question are not the vegetable, but Charles Talbot Onions, the editor of the Oxford English Dictionary.
What?
So the claim is that to know your onions is to be, you know, as smart, as all-knowing as the editor of the Oxford English Dictionary, C.T. Onions. So the problem with this is that the OED's first recorded usage of the phrase know your onions is from 1891, which is before Onions had even gone to university, and he didn't become the editor of the OED until 1922. So it definitely isn't from him, even though it's a ridiculous thought that it would have been. And you know, you really have to have been looking for a stupid explanation to come to the idea that it happens to be just a sort of random editor of the Oxford English Dictionary. It's just so shoehorned. It's very satisfying to put that one to bed. It's not that. So what is it to know your onions? Well, the other common explanation is that it's from Cockney rhyming slang. Onion rings means things. So to know your onions is to know your things. But again,
that makes more sense to me.
It does make more sense. But then why is this phrase coming out of the United States in the late 1800s and not out of Britain?
I mean, okay, so how frequently do you use the term blow a raspberry? That's also from Cockney rhyming slang. And
it is, but it's pretty much the only Cockney rhyming slang that has cut through in the States. Whereas in British vernacular, we use Cockney rhyming slang all of the time. You know, we will say dog and bone for the telephone and stuff like that. I don't quite buy it, but that's, you know, that's just my view, not based on anything other than a hunch. I mean, there is something that supports it actually, because the first citation in the OED, once edited by C.T. Onions, has the phrase as to know your onion rather than to know your onions. Now, if the Cockney rhyming slang is onion rings, then you would say know your onion, not know your onions for things. So I think, you know, that's a vote in favour of it. And it's obviously not impossible that Cockney rhyming slang caught on in America, but why would it catch on there first? I don't know.
I do like that we got the OED themed false explanation there.
Yeah.
Onions was not known for knowing his onions at the time that the...
This is a common thing with the false explanations, is it? It's the thing that it obviously refers to is not what it obviously refers to. And it actually refers to something completely different. It can't possibly be referring to onions. It's referring to a person whose name is onions. It can't possibly be referring to a brass monkey. It has to be referring to a thing that holds cannonballs. And I will continue to fight that one. Take it to the comments if you like. Again, I'm not backing down on that one. I'm going off on one here. A lot of people sent me a picture of a rack on a boat, because this is the idea that the brass monkey's reference to things being cold is a reference to a sort of brace that you put cannonballs in, and when it got cold they would fall out. And they were sending me got a lot of people sending me this image of this rack that says this thing is called a brass monkey. So just because the caption says this thing is called a brass monkey does not mean it's called a brass monkey. And if you look in, I looked in loads of nautical guides, loads of nautical dialect books, none of them have any reference to a monkey, brass or otherwise, being something used to hold cannonballs. Clearly, the detractors got to me, didn't they, Jess? Sorry.
No. It is a recurring thing. And just for the record, unless we say otherwise, we are using like the most credible sources and the most reliable ones out there, including Onions OED.
Yeah. We're not just asking ChatGPT, right, or checking Quora forums. We try to go to people who have looked at multiple sources before they've come to their own conclusions.
It does make my blood boil when someone is like, no, but I asked ChatGPT and Google's AI summary told me. I'm like, that's not a good source. That's just the most optimized collection of information that floated to the top of search.
Yeah. If you want to send Jess something you got from ChatGPT, say you got it from a book.
You mentioned monkeys.
I did in my incensed rant. I did.
We could do some banana idioms. Have we done go bananas? It's an adaptation of the phrase go ape, which dates back to at least like the early 1900s. Then it was adapted into to go bananas, monkeys, bananas, unhinged behavior. And then bananas just itself became the base idiom there. We've got records from as early as like the 1920s of like that's bananas or your bananas. It's even in songs and whatnot. The interesting part is why we think monkeys eat bananas, because monkeys in the wild don't actually eat bananas that much. They almost never eat bananas in their natural habitat. The bananas we know, the sweet seedless Cavendish variety, are domesticated and not found in the wild. When primates do encounter bananas, typically near human habitations, they may enjoy them, but zoos have even phased out feeding them because they're really high in sugar content, which can give your monkeys diabetes. Wild monkeys instead eat, they eat some wild bananas, but they mostly eat seeds and leaves and flowers and nectar and insects and arachnids and things.
To go ape is actually to massacre insects.
Okay. and I got excited about the monkeys. There's also banana oil. It's a 1920s slang for nonsense. It became slang for nonsense because of a chemical, the liquid amyl acetate, discovered in the 19th century, which smelled like bananas and was nicknamed banana oil, and it was widely used in paints, candy flavoring, and perfumes. People knew it was artificial and overpowering, so the name came to suggest something fake or phony. I don't think we use this one quite as much anymore, but Rube Goldberg helped popularize it in his strips in particular, because he used it as a word for bologna or applesauce or horse feathers.
Right.
Just I've all heard, ridiculous stuff.
I obviously heard of a snake oil salesman.
Right.
I don't really understand where that one came from, though.
Scam artists in the Old West would sell you an oil that was said to repel snakes.
Oh, it's to repel snakes. It's not made from snakes.
Okay. No, not. I mean, it might be made from snakes. I'm sure. I'm doing this from memory, so I'm not sure of the exact date on this. So, but my affiliation with it is traveling salesmen in the Old West, and that may be a result of me seeing that in media over time. So it could also have been in a different context entirely. But either way, salesmen who sell snake repellent.
Well, don't knock it till you tried it. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. That's my way of shoehorning in my next idiom.
Very nice. Very nice.
the proof of the pudding. The proof of the pudding being short for the proof of the pudding is in the eating, although a lot of people say the proof is in the pudding, which isn't correct. It's the proof of the pudding is in the eating. The idea that you eat the pudding will then... So prove is being used in a different way to it's used now. So prove is an old meaning of prove, meaning to test. We still have it when we talk about a proving ground, right? That's not somewhere where you show that something is something. You know, you can prove something. Instead, you test it on a proving ground. And that's what the proof of the pudding refers to. It refers to the testing of the pudding. And you test the pudding, in this case, not a dessert, but rather usually it's entrails of a sheep or something like that that are tied up in, smooshed together.
The pudding means very different things.
It does.
Inside of the pot.
It does. So a haggis is a pudding, for example, as Robbie Burns, Rabbi Burns famously described it. But the pudding in this case is, like stuff like boiled stuffed stomach, mincemeat, suet, oatmeal, stuff like that. So it's actually, the phrase is, the testing of the offal is in the eating.
Ah.
There you go. You don't know whether it's good or not unless you eat it.
Pudding over here would more likely have bananas in it than any of that.
And I would use the word pudding to describe something lovely, like a sticky toffee pudding or a treacle sponge pudding, something steamed and sticky. Yes, please.
Delightful.
Custard on there. God. I miss Britain. There is something of a transatlantic difference in what a pie should be as well.
Oh, yeah.
Because to me, a pie is primarily a savory dish, whereas I get the feeling your side is more of a sweet.
That is true. That is true. If you mention pie to someone, they're probably going to think of a fruit pie or an apple pie. Or if you're in New York, then a pizza pie.
Well, I wonder whether a humble pie would be considered a sweet or a savory dish.
Ooh, do you have the origin of that one?
I do have the origin for
Excellent.
This. And it would be a savory dish. You could say it comes from this, but I think it's more likely that it's punning on this. There used to be something called humble pie. And humble is, we're again back to entrails. It's usually the entrails of a deer, right? So you go hunting, the hunters, or the lucky aristocracy who are out on the hunt, they get to eat the nice bits of the deer, the lovely fleshy bits, And, if you're lucky and you're a servant to whoever's caught the thing, they might give you some of the entrails, right? So it's a lowly food. You might get it baked in a pie and you would have been served humble pie, right? So it is itself a humble dish. And the similarity between humble and humble makes for an irresistible pun. So it's likely, rather than the idiom coming from the idea of literally being served humble pie, it's more a convenient pun to say you've been served humble pie, because humble pie is humble.
Right. That's
cool. If I explain that, does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. That's excellent.
Yeah. I know the phrase doesn't go back as far as people were eating humble, for example. It's a 19th century phrase to eat humble pie, whereas humbles have been eaten for a lot longer than that.
Are you familiar with the idiom apple pie order?
No, that's new to me.
It's interesting. I'm going to do two here. One is apple pie order. The other one is American as apple pie. I'm going to address that apple pie, American as apple pie, is not actually that American, but over time, the idioms made it so. Apple pie order dates back to the 1780s with the earliest citation in the diary of Sir Thomas Pasley, a British naval officer who said, "Our men are in apple pie order," the idea being that they are in perfect order. It is perfect as apple pie. And we've got other notions around this time of houses being in apple pie order. Why apple pie is perfect order is a little bit unknown.
He just really liked apple pie. He just personally thought it was excellent.
I don't like this theory, but it is interesting. One theory is that it's sort of an adaptation or a folk etymology mishearing of the French nappe pliée, meaning a folded cloth, something neatly arranged. And that was misheard as sort of apple pie related, which I could buy. Okay, we have other examples of words being adapted in that way, like outrage to outrage, right?
It's not terrible. And I think that is how you would describe a folded tablecloth in French as well.
Apple pie became associated with American as apple pie through a few different mechanisms. One is the notion of Johnny Appleseed, the figure of the American frontier affiliating apples in America. The other notions might be early American cookbooks, which usually included apple pie, even as far back as like the 1700s. The notion of pie having affiliations with prosperity, like you're enjoying delicious apple pie. There was even a 1902 article that stated, no pie-eating people can be permanently vanquished. And that was, I believe, in the New York Times, talking about American success and prosperity. But then apparently it was additionally cemented through World War II, where soldiers declared that they were fighting for mom and apple pie. And that may have kind of firmed the pie up as an American food.
That does sound like a clincher to me.
It's a journey, not just one moment that gave us America and pie.
Jess, a little bird told me that we're running out of time. So can we squeeze in one or two more and then we'll hop it? But first, can I squeeze in a little bird told me? It's not food related, but I thought I ought to bring one or two that isn't. So a little bird told me goes back. You can find quotes including it in like the 16th century. It's really, really old, but where does the idea of a little bird twittering something in your ear come from? Because it's weirdly universal. I look this up in other languages, and most European languages, it seems to me, or at least all of the ones I looked at, had a phrase equivalent to a little bird told me. So what's the sort of universal idea that they're tapping into? And it seems like it's probably from the Old Testament in the Bible. So in the King James Version, in Ecclesiastes 10:20, if you're looking, it says, do not curse the king, even in your thought. Do not curse the rich, even in your bedroom. For a bird of the air may carry your voice, and a bird in flight may tell the matter.
Ooh, little bird rats.
Yeah, that's it, right? Birds, sort of squeal on you. Watch it.
Yeah. Mm. Little snitches.
Birdie snitches get stitches. So that seems like that probably is where it came from. It's that the King James Version of the Bible. Earlier versions do have that reference to the little bird telling on you.
This calls to mind, for me at least, unfortunately, another fruit idiom, because I can't shake those, but it is animal related. The notion of sour grapes being sour grapes about something, like bitter about something, is from Aesop's fable, The Fox and the Grapes. The fox tries to reach a cluster of ripe grapes hanging high on a vine, and when he fails, he declares that they must be sour and unfit to eat. We didn't start using it that regularly until, we have associations between sour grapes and envy and grumpiness as early as the 14th century, but it didn't really become an idiom until like the 1760s. But it is still alluding to Aesop's fables, and then Mark Twain kind of gifted it to us again in the 1800s with Tom Sawyer when a boy says sour grapes, through the same notion of something being unattainable and therefore I didn't want it in the first place.
That image is now going to be in my head every time I hear the phrase sour grapes. That's wonderful. Agree. The image of the fox getting just like, I don't even want no grapes. They're pretty sour.
Right?
Wonderful. Wonderful.
This episode has been the apple of my eye. No bad apples here.
Jess, stop talking about fruit.
Never.
I've enjoyed this. We'll do more idioms episodes. If you haven't seen our other couple of idioms episodes before now, they're well worth a watch as well. We go into things like steal one's thunder. That was a good one.
That was a good one.
What was the one that people kept getting wound up about that you suggested?
I think it was break a leg. I don't even want to talk about that one anymore. Too many theories.
If you want controversy, go and watch our first idioms episode where we discussed that. Thanks for watching this one. We'll catch you in the next Words Unraveled.
See you next time.